Well met, and welcome to episode 57, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for November the 14th, 2010. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and this week we're going to continue our month-long discussion of Richard II with the second half of our plot synopsis. Then we'll finish up with our usual recap of this week's blog entries. When we left off last month, the banished Bolingbroke had returned to England, and despite the support of Richard's lords, the king can see his own reign ending, or as he puts it, the shift from Richard's night to Bolingbroke's fair day. Act 3, Scene 3, takes us back to Bolingbroke's camp, where he learns that the Welsh have dispersed and Richard has returned to England from his Irish wars with only a few private friends. Respect for Richard has waned. Much to York's chagrin, Northumberland fails to use Richard's title in reference to him. Richard arrives on the scene and makes some show of strength before Northumberland, who states that Bolingbroke, once his lands are restored, will give up his army. And Richard agrees. Once Northumberland is gone, however, the king is immediately sorry, saying, "We do debase ourselves, cousin, do we not, to look so poorly and to speak so fair?" He reconsiders showing defiance to Bolingbroke, but descends further into his despair and his own little private pity party. Northumberland returns and says that Bolingbroke will speak to the king, but Richard must come to him. Richard can only say, "Down, down I come, down from his kingly heights." And then comes a truly bizarre exchange in which Bolingbroke kneels before Richard and says that he has come but for his own. Richard then says, "Your own is yours, and I am yours, and all. You are old enough to be my heir. What you will have, I'll give, and willingly too, for do we must what force will have us do." Bolingbroke seems to speak only of his titles and lands, but Richard seems to interpret these statements as if they are about the throne. Richard agrees to give what Bolingbroke wants, or what he thinks Bolingbroke wants. In the fourth and final scene of Act 3, we see the queen in a pity party of her own in her garden. When the gardeners come, she hides and listens to what they have to say. They speak of the sorry state of their country. "Our sea-walled garden is full of weeds, her fairest flowers choked up. And there is no doubt who is at fault. The wasteful king." The queen disparages the common workers for their statements, calling them, "Thou little better thing than earth, thou wretch," before heading out to meet in London, London's king in woe. Once she leaves, we see the reaction of the wretch. It's pity, as he promises to plant a bank of rue in honor of this weeping queen. The common man comes off looking better than the nobles. Again. At the beginning of the single scene of Act 4, at Westminster Hall, Bolingbroke calls forth Bagot, another one of Richard's former advisors/servants, along with Bushy and Green, to present testimony against O'Merle, the Duke of York's son and thus Bolingbroke's own cousin, implicating him in a conspiracy against Bolingbroke himself. When the accusation is made, O'Merle's response is to call for his own trial by combat against his accuser. "There is my gage, the manual seal of death." While Bagot is cautioned by Bolingbroke not to accept the challenge, Fitzwater, Hotspur Percy, and another lord take up the challenge. When only Surrey backs O'Merle's claim, Fitzwater says, "If I dare eat, or drink, or breathe, or live, I dare meet Surrey in a wilderness and spit upon him, whilst I say he lies and lies and lies. Besides, I heard the banished Norfolk say that thou, O'Merle, didst send two of thy men to execute the noble duke at Calais." O'Merle then challenges Norfolk in absentia, and Bolingbroke puts on hold all of these trials by combat until Norfolk be repealed. Even though Norfolk is Bolingbroke's enemy, he will be restored again to all his lands and seigneuries, so that the man accused of plotting his death can defend himself in a trial by combat. When we compare these actions to those of Richard in Act 1, Bolingbroke comes off as the better leader, the more astute and stronger king. When he learns, however, that Norfolk is dead, he proclaims that the trials will take place at a date to be set. York then enters and states that Richard adopts Bolingbroke heir, and his high scepter yields to the possession of Bolingbroke's royal hand. Ascend his throne, descending now from him, and long live Henry, fourth of that name. The only man to speak against this is Carlyle, who states that Bolingbroke is a foul traitor to proud Hereford's king, and prophesizes a vision of the War of the Roses. Of course, Shakespeare knew where this tale was going and had already taken us there. Northumberland, remember he's Papa Percy, then arrests Carlyle for capital treason. Bolingbroke sets Wednesday next as the coronation day and then leaves. Carlyle again predicts dire days ahead, and O'Merrill asks the abbot if there is any plot to rid the realm of this pernicious blot. The abbot tells O'Merrill that there is such a plot, and the scene and act is over. Except for one thing. Between Carlyle's arrest and Bolingbroke's announcement of the date of his coronation is a span of 160 lines. Did you think I skipped that? Well, I did, and so did Shakespeare. Here's what I mean. Those 160 lines do not appear in the first quarto printing of 1597, as well as the subsequent quartos of 1598, 1608, and 1615. In fact, the lines did not appear in print until after Shakespeare's death, 1616, in the 1623 first folio printing. But it's not as if the lines hadn't appeared in the play on stage. Critical opinion is that they did. So what is in those missing lines? The actual deposing of King Richard II. Bolingbroke orders, "Fetch hither Richard, that in common view he may surrender." Richard arrives to wonder why he is called by a king before he has shook off the regal thoughts wherewith he reigned. Richard understands that there is a new king, but he hasn't stopped thinking like one himself. When York asks Richard to do what he had offered, resign the throne, Richard demands that Bolingbroke seize the crown. After Richard then demands that a mirror be brought, and into it he ponders what has happened to himself in his life, Richard dashes the mirror and finally calls Bolingbroke king. Richard then asks that he be taken somewhere out of Bolingbroke's sight, and the new king has him conveyed to the Tower. Richard mocks this and questions the use of the word convey, which also meant to steal. They have stolen him, his essence, his title, his crown, and now they take him away. And the missing lines end. So why were the lines missing in the quarto editions? Well, some have surmised that the scene was too inflammatory. But it's not as if Shakespeare had shied away from depictions of regime change before. See the first tetralogy. Then what makes this one different? Is it because the scene doesn't depict a deposition so much as an abdication? Is abdication worse than deposition? Would it be too painful for an Elizabethan audience, especially one near the close of Queen Elizabeth's reign, to watch a monarch willingly give up the divine right? In Act 5, Scene 1, we find the Queen in London waiting for her husband Richard to pass before her on his way to the Tower. She refers to him as her fair rose, a subtle alignment of Richard to the white rose of York, as opposed to the red rose of Lancaster, who had John of Gaunt as its root. While Richard is a man broken, our former state a happy dream, the queen is stronger and incredulous to his change. What, is my Richard both in shape and mind transformed and weakened? Richard then complains that he has been doubly divorced, not just from his crown, but he from his wife as well. And what follows is a mature and touching goodbye between husband and wife. But wait a minute. Hadn't Bolingbroke himself insinuated a homosexual relationship between Richard and Bushian Green? Remember their sinful hours having created a divorce betwixt his queen and Richard, broke the possession of a royal bed? Well, maybe, but there seems to be real affection here between Richard and his queen. Now, while both sex with Bushian Green and affection for his queen may not be mutually exclusive, it does call into question Bolingbroke's accusation and his motivation. Was it a smear campaign? And if so, how much worse does that make our view of our new king? In Act 5, Scene 2, we move from the marriage of the deposed king to the household of the Duke of York. Here we learn that as Richard went through the streets of London, dust and rubbish was thrown down upon him by the rude misgoverned. York then says that he has come to London to appear before Parliament and pledge for his son's truth and last fealty to the new-made king. Remember, York's son O'Merle had openly supported Richard, and because of this, his titles had been stripped and now has been demoted to Rutland. What's worse, however, is that York finds on O'Merle Rutland himself proof of the abbot's plot to kill the king at Oxford. There is then a slightly funny sequence in which York calls upon his servants to bring him his saddle and then his boots so he can go and warn the king. This farcical slapstick, or at least I can definitely see it played that way, is wacky given the solemnity of all that has come before, but the scene itself has a very important and serious purpose. What we see in the York household is a microcosm of what is happening and what will happen all through England. Breakdowns of family loyalty caused by the usurpation of the crown. York leaves to warn the king, and the Duchess tells her son to go to the king and beg his pardon ere his father do accuse him. Act 5, Scene 3 opens with Bolingbroke on the throne as Henry IV, bemoaning his unthrifty son. It's a nice lead-in to the two parts of Henry IV, which will deal with Prince Hal's reformation, one that is foreshadowed even here as Henry says that he sees some spark of better hope, which elder years may happily bring forth. What makes this foreshadowing play even better is to whom Henry is complaining. Percy. Not Papa Percy, but the son. That's right, he's complaining to Hotspur. Gotta love that. Well, into this scene comes O'Merle, ready to confess. Henry excuses everyone else and asks his cousin what the problem is. Now, it's interesting that although Henry knows of a possible plot by O'Merle to kill him, he still allows himself to be in a room alone with him. O'Merle says that he needs to tell Henry something, but wants a pardon first. Henry's response is all preemptive forgiveness, basically saying, as long as you only thought about it and didn't actually do it, I forgive you. And just as O'Merle is about to confess, who should come banging on the locked door but York, warning the king of a traitor in his presence there. Henry draws his sword for protection, and you think this is all about to go south and sad in a hurry. But it doesn't. Henry lets York in, York shows him the evidence, and what does Henry do? He lives up to his word to O'Merle, telling York, and thy abundant goodness shall excuse this deadly plot in thy digressing son. York's response sends the tone of this scene back to the comic wackiness of the preceding scene's slapstick, however. York won't allow it. He wants his son executed. Interrupting this plea to have his son killed is the arrival of the Duchess of York pleading for the life of her son. Henry's response is purely comic. Our scene is altered from a serious thing, and now changed to the beggar and the king. The Duchess grovels on the floor and begs for leniency. O'Merle kneels for forgiveness. York kneels for justice against both son and wife. Meanwhile, Henry just wants them all to stand. But the Duchess will not rise until Henry pardons her son, which he had already done. Henry's response is an interesting one. I pardon him as God shall pardon me. What a wonderfully complex statement. Is it just wishful thinking on Henry's part? Does he believe himself justified in deposing Richard? Is he planning to punish O'Merle and knows that he will be punished by God for Richard? The mother's response, however, brings the King of England's divine right to rule. A God on earth thou art. But he's not an all-forgiving God. The other members of O'Merle's plot, the ones who haven't begged for pardon, are to be captured and then executed. They shall not live within this world, I swear. In the short Act 5, Scene 4, a Sir Exton interprets an overheard statement of Henry's as an order to murder Richard. This murder takes place in Act 5, Scene 5, after a long soliloquy by Richard as he looks upon his state and compares this prison where he lives unto the world. It's a long and beautiful speech befitting a poet king, and we'll discuss it further later in the month on the blog, I'm sure. Suffice to say, however, Exton and an accomplice rush in and kill the deposed king. The sixth and final scene of the act and of the play takes us back to the palace where Henry welcomes Northumberland, who tells of sending to London the heads of Salisbury, Spencer, Blunt, and Kent, for which Henry can only thank gentle Percy. Gotta love irony there. Fitzwater has also sent the heads of Brocas and Seeley to London. Hotspur announces that the Abbot of Westminster has yielded up his body to the grave as well. Henry tells Carlyle to find a secret place to either exile himself or die. Into all this talk of traitors and executions comes Exton with the body of Richard. Henry is stunned. He never asked for this. Yes, he wanted him dead, but never ordered it. In a sense, does this parallel the regime change? Did Henry want the crown, but wouldn't take it until it was given? Henry ends the play with a promise to make a pilgrimage to the Holy Land to wash this blood off from his guilty hand. and the play in Richard II is done. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries this week, you've missed out on subjects including the deposition that isn't, the deposition that is, tragical historical comical, Barbary, gaunt rhetoric, and sources. So, if you'd like a more in-depth discussion or want just a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page. Remember that the Facebook page is more for Shakespeare news and notes than daily discussions of our play of the month. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And of course, please join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for November the 14th, 2010. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon.